There's obviously many aspects of an industry that's super regulated that we need to have a potentially different posture around how we think of generative AI. But suffice to say, there's opportunities for generative AI to advance and augment what we're doing, whether it's early drug discovery and finding new therapies faster and in more affordable ways for patients, supply chains to be much more sustainable and robust.
Tracy, welcome to the Data Bytes podcast. I'm so looking forward to this conversation because it has been a busy year for all of us working in the space of AI, but particularly generative AI. And you are the CDO and Global Generative AI Lead for Life Sciences at Accenture. So I'm sure you have had an incredibly busy year. So thank you so much for taking the time to come in and chat with us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to speak, Sadie. You guys are up to lots of exciting things as well. So tons of things to discuss.
Definitely. So when we think about AI and generative AI, oftentimes the word life sciences doesn't come up right away. So can you just give us a little bit of a background of what does leveraging AI in life sciences look like? And what is the opportunity that's there?
Great question. And I would say, you know, many industries are at different points in their journey as it relates to generative AI and overall artificial intelligence. For me, you know, there's obviously many aspects of an industry that's super regulated that we need to have a potentially different posture around how we think of generative AI. But suffice to say, there's opportunities for generative AI to advance and augment what we're doing, whether it's early drug discovery and finding new therapies faster and in more affordable ways for patients, supply chains to be much more sustainable and robust. And the way that we're reaching, you know, healthcare providers and patients can be really tuned. And some places say all of the core office functions and finance and HR, legal, et cetera, all of those are very similar to other industries in the ability to reshape and increase, I think, the competitive edge that an organization can gain.
So when we think about life sciences, it typically is in the realm of like microbiology, biology, biochemistry, sales, right? All about the study of living organisms and life processes. How does that look? What are the types of businesses that work in this space? You mentioned healthcare. Does that also fall under the branch of life sciences here as well?
So we don't combine healthcare and life sciences. We consider life sciences to be therapeutics as it relates to, you know, drugs, consumer healthcare, things that you might find in a pharmacy that are over-the-counter, medical devices. So anything that you might have a tracker or an implant that may go into you surgically. So that is the majority of the industry. We also cover the distribution angle around it. So, you know, pharmaceuticals are always working in a three-tier system. So it's all of the aspects of bringing those products to market, commercializing them, and then also organizations that are pushing them out to your retail stores or compound pharmacies or to hospitals or other areas that you may be getting, you know, vaccines or surgery. So all of those would be what we would consider. But suffice to say, as you mentioned, lots and lots of science under the hood, irrespective of whether you're thinking of a medical device or an actual, you know, mRNA therapy.
So what do you see as some of the key opportunities and challenges in implementing these AI solutions across the various functions and life cycles of life sciences?
Yeah, and the opportunity is clear, right? We know based on our research, you know, 39% of time will be augmented or automated. That's not to be confused with the idea that, you know, 4 out of every 10 hours are going to go away, or that, you know, I have a lot of individuals ask, does that mean 4 out of 10 jobs are going away? Absolutely not what we're saying. But we are saying that simplifying and expediting any type of capability. So I'll give you a great example of one that I'm working on now, which is regulatory filing is a very, very complex, needs to be exactly correct, has a lot of rigor related to it, but there's also a lot of repetitive work, right? So we're taking content that could be coming, you know, through all of the, you know, many data sources and putting it into standard contracts. And so taking text and putting it into a table, taking table and putting it into text, you know, creating, you know, summarization of documents, et cetera. So many things that are really perfectly tuned for generative AI to be creating traditional AI, to be augmenting and, you know, more simplification. And so that that phase around tuning a large language model into a way that we can, you know, create that 39% to make that individual's role more efficient. And that we see that, again, a lot of what you hear me talk about is the speed, right? Because the most important thing is getting the therapy into patients, right? And so the less time that it's spent doing things that are non-patient related, the later it's going to come, the more lives that could not be impacted. So regulatory filing is a perfect use case and one that I'm quite excited about. Albeit many others that I think all are in that same idea of how do we compress to create healthful solutions faster.
I think that's fantastic because recently I've been reading about how many amazing advancements there are in science and drug discovery and bioengineering that are really just stuck in a pipeline of regulatory compliance and approval. So the faster that, you know, we definitely don't want to cheat the system in any regard because these are set up for individuals' protection. However, if we can optimize that supply chain and optimize that process, it means more lives saved faster, which is just fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that important part here is that we are still looking at this as a way that there is always a human in the loop here, right? There's still a human that is reviewing, approving, et cetera, but taking that items that are error prone or mundane or repetitive and compressing those, that's where there's an incredible value proposition. Not saying that we won't see other opportunities coming in the future, but, you know, most certainly, you know, it's important to really think about that human in the loop aspect, particularly on, you know, very, very important aspects. There's a study done recently about, is it more difficult, you know, what are the most difficult things to apply AI to? And, you know, sort of self-driving cars was much further down on the complexity level than it was creating and imagining new molecular designs, right? And of course, you can imagine that the same study also said that, you know, it's also more impactful if you get it wrong, right? And so just comparing those two scenarios, I think is a powerful way to think about, you know, even organizations at the forefront of drug discovery, this is highly, highly complex. And generative AI is not going to solve the most vexing problems of an industry that we've been grappling with for decades and decades, right? But it can make them simpler, faster, and more accurate.
Definitely. And, you know, we've already been seeing advancements in this space prior to this year, Gen AI taking over the field of AI, just with things like AlphaFold. I mean, that was a major breakthrough in being able to sequence DNA and the protein folding, which, again, just helps with that speed to discovery, which is what we're all looking for in instances like this. So if an individual is interested in not only AI, but particularly in the life sciences of really having that human impact of being able to save lives, what's the background that individuals need to work in this space?
Great question, because I think most of my team and the individuals that are working on this, we're really seeing that background in science is really, really imperative. But this idea that data is still paramount, and this coalescence of the, you know, math and the science coming together is probably tracking at the same level of importance as we're seeing, you know, generative AI kind of come onto the scene right now. And so there's a lot of blur between that. I would tell you that I have more individuals that have PhDs that are working in and around data science than I ever imagined would happen. And these are medical doctors that have, you know, come out of the field and realize that the data is where their passion is. So getting very involved, you know, particularly when we think on the drug discovery side in the science is an important background. But just like other industries, we have, you know, a very important and robust supply chain, right? And so all of those capabilities are critical. A customer experience, again, very important as we think about commercializing. So the entire portfolio of capabilities is important to bring forward. But I would be remiss to say that, you know, all of good AI is rooted in good data. And so we all are, you know, focused deeply on making sure that the data is robust. You know, the way that we're training our models is in a way that is very, very sophisticated, rooted in an incredible data foundation. And I think that view of what is data is so much more broad, right? When I started my career 25 years ago, we were thinking about structured data, right? That was coming across in tables or out of the mainframe, et cetera. We're looking at medical imagery and doing, you know, computer vision to compare these to drive, you know, better, faster diagnoses around oncology, right? These are things that, you know, so the world of data has gotten much broader aperture of what we consider data to be.
When you think about the future of technology advancements in life sciences, what are you most excited about? I mean, there's been talk of nanobots for a while and how, you know, there's going to be nanobots living in all of our blood cells and systems. Is it AI advancements? What excites you most about technology advancements in the life sciences area if we're looking out the next 3, 5, or even 10 years?
I think there's a few that are really, really interesting. And there's always an interesting angle when you think about life sciences that we're thinking about how is regulation informing that drug pipeline. And one thing that I'm quite excited about is, you know, things like rare diseases. When you're looking at an individual that may be in a patient cohort of, you know, only 100,000 people worldwide, there isn't necessarily a great commercial use case for organizations to go after and pursue therapies around this. But as we start to see some of this data coming in and applying AI, using synthetic data, right, where we're federating data off of multiple cases, potentially creating consortiums of data, right, and thinking through that, I'm wildly excited about the idea of this rare disease concept and solving, you know, those situations, diagnosing earlier, right? A lot of times you'll see a rare disease patient have a 2 to 10 year timeline that they've been, you know, in and out of multiple procedures, et cetera. I mean, the excitement for me is that imagine the patient experience is much better and they're feeling better sooner, but also the cost to the overall health system when you can't diagnose something is incredible. And so rare disease is very passionate in my heart. I also think that the idea of, you know, being able to have more successful clinical trials, we're still seeing phase 3 failures. It's an incredible loss to have something go through all of that research and then fail at phase 3. And so for me, you know, those of us that worked in software and data have always talked about failing fast on your technological projects, right? Well, I really hope that we're failing fast as we're thinking about drug discovery and abandoning, you know, therapies that are not going to work and focusing on the ones that can.
Couldn't agree more. Yes, I think there's a lot of opportunity of like, can we use technology to create simulation models that allow us to run some of these trials without having harm to anyone and can make sure that we can get to that regulatory approval faster. I also love what you share about the rare diseases. I think many of us heard the story when ChatGPT first came out of the individual who put all their medical records in, and ChatGPT was able to come up with one of the solutions for what they're experiencing, which was a rare disease. And so I think just the potential to be able to have that data all at hand all at once is really, really incredible. One of the things you also do is you work a lot in the space of advancing diversity and inclusion in technology. You've mentioned you've mentored a lot of female technologists. Can you share some strategies or advice for fostering diversity and supporting underrepresented groups in technology?
Yeah, it's a great segue, because I actually think that the concepts in and around creating a responsible AI solution, one of the most important things that we can do is have a diverse set of individuals creating, designing, testing, and experiencing, right? There's many, many examples that I could talk through about how, unconscious bias or just the fact that everybody was in a certain demographic or a certain gender that they've completely missed something as they're thinking about it. And so having diverse teams and having diverse councils guiding AI is something that I really think will be, an incredible tool to kind of enforce that. I also think that, creating, the number of individuals that come to me and say, we're so excited that we have a female leader that's there. So representation will always be important. And having, someone that people can relate to, that they believe, create the pathway for them is important. And I think it's incredibly important for all individuals to lift up others and create those pathways. And so I always try to think about a huge mindset of abundance. Ruth Bader Ginsburg always said, how many women on the Supreme Court is enough? And she said, what if it was all women? And I always think, what are we, we do set goals around, how to, be more diverse and, aspire to many of those. But I think, that mindset of being really inclusive is an important aspect, both as we're thinking about the talent angle and who we bring together, but also how we're shaping and informing the future of technology.
You have an accomplishment that may not be listed so much as a professional accomplishment, but I'm quite jealous of, which is you summited Mount Kilimanjaro. First, can you tell us a little bit about how did that come to be? And what was your experience? And what did you learn from that experience in terms of overcoming challenges and achieving success? I'm sure it has a lot of benefits in your business life and career as well.
Yeah, I actually compare the two a lot. You can imagine when you're hiking a mountain for 8 days, you have lots and lots of things and lots of free time for your mind to be cleared and all of that. For my 40th birthday, I wanted to do something that for me was epic. And so Kilimanjaro was my epic 40th birthday. But I do talk a lot that while I was hiking, I was thinking how it was dramatically similar to technology, that you're planning, you're thoughtful. So we were training. I spent hours and hours on a step mill. I spent almost every weekend hiking a mountain that's near my home. And it's not different. We train really hard. We practice just like that as we think about being intentional in technology. And the best part that for me was the summit is just when you go live, but sometimes the journey really is still continuing. So after I summited, it was a 2-day hike down. And boy, I thought about, this is just similar to all technology, right? Just because you've implemented it, the journey is not over. And I think one thing that I always try to celebrate really, really big with my project teams when we've gone live with an implementation and celebrate our client success. But it definitely reminded me how important it is to, memorialize great successes. And I guess the last bit I would say is that, yes, I hiked a big mountain. And yes, I've done lots of really, really big, big, big implementations and have some wonderful experiences. But sometimes it's about celebrating the really small things and the glimmers of hope that happen every single day. The individual that, comes to you and says, I have this small experience and it really changed the whole trajectory of my career, or they had a light turn on. So I love my Kilimanjaro summit, but I also think every single day there's small summits that we go through and cherishing those is incredibly important.
Yes, I think that's such a great reminder, is just to celebrate the little wins along the way, because I don't know about you, but typically after I've achieved a major milestone, when I look back at it, yes, achieving the milestone is fantastic. But what I remember most was the days that I still showed up in the gym or still showed up in the hike, just your average every day where you showed up and prepared for that moment sometimes are the most memorable. And so I think it's a great reminder for all of us during this time to celebrate the little wins today. So if you're listening to this, take some time and write down, what was your win for today, right? What was your win for in the last hour and the last moment? That's fantastic. So any mountains next or any summits next on your list? Or
I have to tell you, I don't know that there will be one anytime soon. But I I definitely think that setting really, really incredible goals is something that I really aspire to, and thinking about, you know, how to continue to challenge myself, but maybe not in a month.
So in your 20 years of experience, is there one piece of advice you'd give to professionals aspiring to reach leadership roles in the data and AI field, and particularly in the life sciences sector?
So I talk a lot about this concept of, and I just had this discussion about a week ago with someone, and I said, you know, it's really important that you have your council of advisors. And as you start your career, your council of advisors needs to be somebody that's a mentor. There needs to be somebody that can, you know, really challenge you and tear things apart in a positive way that doesn't feel destructive. Someone that you can, you know, sort of vent and just walk through kind of the emotional aspects and, you know, filling out, you know, they might not be all the same, you know, three people. They should not definitely be one person, right? Because you want different roles, just like any government official has a cabinet of advisors. I recommend that everybody have their cabinet. Sometimes for women, I call it their Chico system. I also think that it's important to think about how you are reshaping that every single year. And, you know, as you progress, I really hope you outgrow your cabinet, right? And that you really are finding new individuals. And at some point in time that you're thinking, who am I an advisor for? Right. And so how are you working that broader picture? Because incredibly important as we can get so focused and so mired into kind of the day in and day out. I think it's really important that you have folks that can help lift you out, to give a broader perspective, to challenge you. And I also think that it's very, very important to really have something in our lives that you're giving back. I give back and participate in a number of women leadership groups. I locally support items in my city for local entrepreneurs and mentoring there. But I think it's really important to have a very holistic view on how you're, you know, both challenging yourself as well as how you're challenging others, and having that really, you know, core group of challengers and advisors is critical to get into place and have the conversation. There are people that are my secret mentor that I would never say, you know, I aspire to be like Sadie, and I watch her on LinkedIn and I think she's amazing. But the people that are really part of that core group, you should sit down and have a discussion. And the last bit is I would say that a lot of times people come to me and ask if I will be their, you know, people leader or their coach. And after we decide if that's a fit or not, I always end with the question of the only way that I'll do it is if you promise to give me feedback as well. And so really be consciously soliciting feedback, because I personally fell into a trap for many years where I just thought, yeah, you're great, you're wonderful, you're good. But I was stagnating, and I had to get someone who was a really big challenger to help, you know, help me make that up level movement. And so really think about all of those aspects and how you round out your career and charting the trajectory that you aspire to.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I'm a big fan of having what I call like my personal board of advisors, right? I'm like, if organizations and massive companies have a board of advisors, why would we not as individuals also have our own personal board of advisors? Like it makes a lot of sense. And we talk in this space about how important diversity is and diversity of mindset. And so, again, not just having that one individual, but multiple. What I see a lot of individuals struggling with is how to find a mentor. And for me, a lot of them just happen organically. And they may not even, like you said, know they're my mentor. It's just I'm able to ping them, ask them a question, get some advice. But any particular advice for individuals in terms of how to find those people and know it's a good fit? To either be a mentor, a sponsor, or on your personal board of advisors?
For me, I get a lot of individuals asking, and I can immediately know whether someone is going to be a great fit. You know, it's, you know, depending on how much, let's say, homework they've done or how much they've been thoughtful about what they want to get out of it, right? I'm not the best mentor for all things. And so a lot of times, you know, I think coming in with a really strong view of what you want to get out of the mentorship, and being clear about it and asking for it. So again, having the conversation, Sadie, would you be my mentor? I think that you bring these, you know, things to bear that I really like to benefit from. And thinking about that. And I also, again, to the point of, you know, a equal share, I learn as much from my mentees as I learn from my mentors at times. So be thoughtful about what you're going to bring to the table. And you know, sort of selling that, if you will, for lack of a better word, you know, becoming, coming to someone and asking for their time, which for me is probably my least, my scarcest resource, so to speak, is time. You know, I think, you know, coming really, really well, informed about what you want and what you want to get. And I think I would just leave one other point on this, which is if someone says they won't mentor you or that they don't have capacity, et cetera, I don't think that you should take it as a bad sign. It might just be that it's the wrong fit at that time and place. It might be that they actually think that someone else would do a much better job at the role. Right. And so, be willing to take no as an answer. And that is in no way a sign or an indication that they don't care about you. It may mean that they care more about you than you think.
Yes, I think that is a great reminder. It can always be hard to deal with no's, but no's are usually what lead us to that best next step in our life or career, whatever that may be. I think it's just reminding that no is the right yes is just right around the corner. And also, more importantly, too, you know, it is a two-way relationship, a mentorship. It never is one person telling another. Just as you mentioned, you learn from your mentees. I learn from my mentees, my mentors. It goes both ways. And I think always keeping that in mind is what helps set individuals up for success in any mentorship. Well, Tracy, I want to just say thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast today and share your wisdom, experience, and learnings with us, knowing that it is the most scarce resource. I appreciate that you've given us some of this valuable resource. I know many will benefit from this conversation. We'll be sure to include links to your socials in the show notes as well so individuals can follow along. But any final thoughts as we wrap up today?
No, I think this is fantastic and I love this community. I think the whole idea of being curious, learning and growing is quite important and something that if we all continue to challenge ourselves, whether it's learning something new or hiking a mountain or you know, training your large language models, I think that is an incredible thing to kind of build and foster. So thank you. It's really been my honor.
Likewise. And a big thank you to our listeners. Remember to stay curious and keep learning. And we'll catch you next time on the Data Bites podcast. Bye-bye, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Data Bites podcast. If you're looking for more resources to further your data career or find your tribe, we encourage you to become a member at womenindata.org. See you on the other side.